So, hello everyone. My name's Emily Labrum, and I'm a product manager at a startup called BiblioCloud. And normally I would spend any moment in the public eye talking about safe things like metadata and workflow transformation, but today I've taken a very daring move to talk about something much, much, much more personal. And that's how I got inspired by a quiet movement of women called the Red Tent Movement to rediscover my period. And then to get so inspired by that, that I ended up re-architecting my entire working life and my life around it. And so I'm going to share with you the kind of early findings from this experiment that I've been taking with menstrual leave, and also the implications that I see from that experiment on the tech world and also the kind of economy beyond. So the really, really personal bit. So like a lot of women, for most of my adult life I've been on the pill, and for me that meant not having any periods at all. And for a long time, 5 years, I celebrated my kind of steadiness, my lack of the ups and downs that I heard some of my friends talking about. And it wasn't until I attended my first women's circle where I felt a little dubious and doubtful as a feminist what was going on here, that I heard about the menstrual cycle as a tool for self-knowledge, and for the first time decided, actually, I wondered what the effect of the pill was on me, and got inspired to actually reinstate my period and find out whether I could actually make use of those ups and downs, in fact. And so I decided to come off the pill. Unlike a lot of other people with periods, I started using these period tracker apps to chart how I was feeling on any day and to start to understand and see the patterns in what I was needing and how to kind of tailor my life to that. It was extremely exciting, but then I hit Christmas last year, and being on my period over Christmas struck me as it was the most intolerable experience of being in this phase where I wanted actually to retreat, but instead was obliged to be spending all this time kind of socializing and playing games, and it got me to think that actually I wasn't just cyclical, and in fact this is what one gets told at women's circles, but in fact seasonal. And as we ovulate in summer, it's the summer season, but as we, you know, become premenstrual, it's that awful autumn time, and where we're having to let go and retreat, and menstruation is actually the winter. And it made me think, actually, do I need to take days off work in order to really honour this time and to discover whether I'm actually experiencing any kind of summer? Because without the rest, how can we really tell whether we are, without the down, how can we have the up? Hence the experiment. So I decided to take a deep breath and ask my boss, instead of a promotion or a pay rise, I asked for time, a flexible time, so that I could take days off of my period. And this was helped by the fact that I worked for a woman-owned company, and so we were able, she instantly got fired up by this in her own right. And so suddenly I had this opportunity to take days off once a month or once a cycle, and I wondered initially, what do I do now? So I typed in how to rest into Google, and there wasn't much advice actually, and it was, so I had to start thinking, oh, well, what does nature do during, this is winter, what does nature do during winter? And experiment with behaving like a hibernating creature. So, like a little curled up rat, I take days where I just connect to myself and the ground, stop everything, I don't talk for two, so the last 2 days that I was on period leave, I arranged with my housemates that they wouldn't talk to me. And so I put my screens away, I put my projects down, and I went into hibernation. So my inquiry was instead of, for example, I was on period leave this week when I would otherwise be kind of preparing for this talk, instead I had to put it completely down and feel instead what I'd been suppressing the last cycle, what was in my body, what has, and the last part, so after not only hibernating, also feeling, but also envisioning. So I journaled, I drew, I created, I started to imagine what I could bring forth in the next cycle. And I had to let everything else go. And so these are my findings so far from this unique experiment. Firstly, I suppose that very familiar to anyone who's ever taken a holiday, a sense of perspective. So in that letting go, all of those projects that had felt so lost some of their craft, you know, a lot of the feelings that I had associated with them, the pressures, let go. And in that came a certain efficiency that I was then able to see having, it's for example, perhaps with a creative project, you can see what you can leave away. With a code base, I could see where we could refactor. It was an entire kind of a sense of energy returning that I could then direct in new shoots, new green shoots. And in that listening quiet phase, I found inspiration. So visions of what I could actually bring to birth in this next cycle, both in my working life and also my own life. And then finally, energy. So when my body is saying to rest and I'm able to rest, it's this wonderful, the wonderful byproduct is that I then actually have the energy during that spring and summer season. I'm so booming now during kind of week three of my cycle that I have to go on runs. As a very unathletic person, this has come as a surprise. And I also have extra energy to give to other people. So this was a leap of faith. I didn't know that I would then be abundant with energy, but I now am. So for some of my cycle, I'm able to, you know, offer up that time and energy, work harder actually. And it's led me to want to completely restructure my working life around this. Finally, evolution. Instead of trying to do the same thing harder and harder and harder, now I have this monthly opportunity to course correct. You know, it becomes clear where I'm wasting energy and also where energy can then be redirected. And in that I'm seeing adaptation as an alternative to just growth through production. So why it has worked for me is there are some quite unique things about my working culture, which I also feel that would actually benefit everyone else. One is a culture of being real. So at work, it's kind of okay to cry, to have these sorts of conversations. I feared being seen as a crazy weakling in, you know, making this request, and everyone has been prepared to rally around me to see whether this experiment bears out. Secondly, community. So the fact that I take time off means that other people have to, there's give and take, other people have to take on my work for 2 days. And likewise, it means that I'm modelling a new, more flexible way of living, of working, and that works because other people in my workplace are parents. You know, my CEOs are both working parents who leave at 3 p.m. every day, and we have had to learn how to work in an asynchronous way where we're not entirely overlapping all the time, but instead are able to just, you know, work according to our own rhythms and the needs of our families and of our lives. Finally, what's kind of rare about my company is that we are bootstrapped and we are, I would say, growth agnostic. So we don't have shareholders to impress with monthly growth targets. We have conversations about what our life goals are and our life needs, and then how many clients and customers we need in order to, you know, achieve those goals for ourselves. And with that, it means that we have a sort of base camp style culture where we don't have to exert ourselves to every single last drop for the sake of, you know, selling out down the line. that's never going to happen, and instead we're able to actually dedicate our energies to discovering our customers and pleasing them for our own sakes. And in that, it's a culture where I've been able to take crazy experiments in my working patterns like this. Some lofty thoughts about the possible implications of this. I was seeing that the qualities of my working culture would actually benefit everyone, especially parents and those with caring responsibilities. And I really hope that what I'm able to do is to invite others to bring their needs to the table, that as someone, for example, who has, as a very white company, that we might be able to actually, in so doing, foster a more inclusive place to work. And finally, I'm also seeing some commercial benefits in seeing my incredibly overworked colleagues start to take weekends for the first time. Our company the code base inflated to 400 Ruby models through the kind of sheer exertion of my founders who worked evenings and weekends for the last 4 years. And now that they're starting to be able to take some time away, we're actually seeing our own code base start to, to reduce in technical debt at the same time. So my question really is, how far will I take this? Will I redefine my own working pattern completely? Could we throw away the entire working week? It is arbitrary. It was created for, industrial machines, not humans. Do we all, in fact, have cycles that we can honour? Can we follow the cues of our bodies rather than convention? Can we redefine our economic worldview? He has donut economics, which is a cyclical alternative to linear-style infinite growth, whereby we create this safe and just space for humanity, which is dependent upon the environmental factors being kept in check and also human needs being met through through housing and gender equality, etc. I see the implications of cycles on every scale. And ultimately, I've started to look to nature rather than to my competitors for inspiration in creating the kind of mutually beneficial symbiotic relationships with our customers that we see, for example, in the bee and the flower, that in this fair exchange of nectar and pollination, that we see this kind of beautiful, mutually beneficial system. And in the same way, I'm finding myself, having moved out of London, able to to take cues from nature every week and every season, and notice how I can actually follow the same little adaptations and innovations that nature has in reducing waste particularly and meeting needs better. So actually to grow through adaptation rather than through consuming more on an unfortunately finite planet. So finally, some closing thoughts. I feel that in this tech industry, we are great at spring and summer. Sometimes we're also great at autumn, that moment of retrospection, for example. But we have not, and I think society at large is not comfortable with winter, with rest, and with dropping everything. And actually, I would love to invite everybody to get curious about cycles and to identify those moments in each of our energetic rhythms, our daily rhythms, our hourly rhythms, and our rhythms of engagement with work, our creative cycles, where the moments where we are feeling fired up and the moments where we're feeling just utterly, utterly knackered and frustrated, and to track them, chart them, and then honour them, and find ways, even in stolen times, to honour those nadirs, the moments where actually we're dipping, rather than pushing through. And so menstrual cycles are only one of many. Let's all have permission, in fact, to work with rather than against our cycles, and actually let nature be our inspiration for a more human and sustainable way to work and live. Thank you.
about design thinking, which is something that is laden with a lot of entrepreneurial meaning. And I'm totally qualified to talk about this, by the way, because I write code for a living. I got to write code for a living because of design thinking, and that's a story for a break. But since you're all here today, I'm going to assume that you have an idea of some sort, some way of changing your corner of the world, squirreled away somewhere, and maybe you don't know where to start, or maybe you haven't quite got the confidence, or maybe you simply don't, haven't tried it before, maybe you failed. Okay, this is for you. For any other people who don't necessarily have ideas, I have gifts, so please stay. So I thought I should give an example of an idea, and this is one a lot of people are familiar with. We struggle to get nutrients, quality nutrients, into our bodies. This is something we've been obsessed with as a Western culture over the past 2-3 years, trying to get plant-based, healthy, wholesome nutrients into our bodies as often as possible and in a sustainable way, so everybody's happy, saving the planet, creating very little waste. So that's probably a good idea, right? Because we've been chasing it for a long time. Probably. Does that look familiar? So as long as it's not a NutriBullet or a blender, I was willing to look into this idea because I just don't get on with objects like that. Do you know this? This is a juicero. It's a rather marvelous machine, and it makes everything very, very easy for you. You buy these pouches which contain raw ingredients. They are pre-mixed. You put it in a machine, and within minutes, you have. So I'm still trying to work with that. Okay. It's really, really very simple. It also looks very good. And within minutes, you have a drink that is healthy. It's sustainable because Juicero, okay, it's sustainable if you live in California because Juicero is kind of thing being local. So they have created their own farm community around this product. And they have lots and lots of pouches. You can mix it up. You can have kale one day and many other things. There's literally no effort. You don't have to peel anything. Everything's raw. It's farm to glass and it's all yummy and great, and you might actually make it on Instagram, which if you're an introvert like me is probably a big deal. I'm sold so far. Except when you do the math and people have. It's actually quite expensive. I don't know what that build is. Anyway, it's expensive. It works up to around £1,400 a year, which is fine, I suppose. You could pay that price for an ethical product if it does what it says, except some guys at Bloomberg decided they were going to squeeze a pouch with their bare hands, save £400, put it all over the internet, and make everybody very, very angry. I think I'm just going to use the mouse. Sorry. Okay, so do you think Juicero is a failed idea in this case? I would argue that it isn't, if you're an engineer. I mean, the machine itself is a beautiful piece of engineering. The door is beam-blasted aluminium. The hinges on the door are space-grade gears and bushings. And it's just a really, really fantastically engineered machine. So 10 custom machined parts, 2 custom dowel pins, 2 steel molded parts, 1 solenoid, and all of that just to keep the door closed. This thing delivers the exact same pressure over 64 square inches, and that's really fantastic. So it all started with this man. Doug Hoves, the former CEO, and he proudly announced that this machine of his delivered 4 tons of force, which was enough to lift 2 Teslas in the air, and then a lot of people threw a lot of money at them, including Google, and it was considered a startup success, an economic success, and an engineering success. $120 million dollars founding without even shipping a single product. Was it a success? Okay, so this is a classical thing that happens in technology. The customer asks for a banana, and you get a gorilla holding a banana in the jungle. So what do I mean? Okay, let's take a look at how we do things and how we build things. This is a pretty sensible model. You have an idea, you build it, you launch it, you measure it, you learn from it, and then you go all the way again. Right, it's sensible, except it doesn't work, because this tends to happen. Whoops. Okay, so enter design thinking. What is design thinking? It's a new mindset around taking an idea from A to B and, you know, failing is still okay, but doing something more. So there's a misconception that you have to be a designer to do design thinking. It's not true. What it is, it's actually taking into consideration, as well as challenging, the needs of the people, the possibilities of technology, and your requirements for success. And this is just technological products. It's lots of things. I've seen design thinking applied to environmental policy. It probably could apply to global conflicts of some sort, if someone was keen enough to try it. There's five ingredients to design thinking, but you have to start with the assumption that you can't solve a problem by using the same sort of thought that you used to create it. So this is where this comes in. You have to flip everything on its head, you have to completely free your mind, and you have to start with empathy, which luckily is innate in most people, except we usually consciously or subconsciously tend to make judgment and form opinions about people and situations. So you have to get rid of that completely with design thinking. You have to start by stripping your ego, and you have to start by listening and being really, really compassionate. Okay, that's clearly not what happened with this product. Second of all, and this is very important, once you have synthesized, once you've been empathetic to everyone around you and notice that they have a problem, you synthesize what you've learned and you turn it into one actionable problem statement. So, for example, you don't say, oh, why can't old people use the internet? You use a statement of the form, how might we make technology more accessible to elderly people who are in digital confidence? So it's just a way of rephrasing that helps you think in a different way, but most importantly, you can act on it right now. And phrasing problems like that helps you also not end up with something that is biting off too much than you can chew. Third of all, ideate. So you've got some learnings, you've got an actionable problem statement. Now all you have to do is let your imagination run wild and go. Have ideas, and absolutely don't be afraid if you think something is ridiculous. Follow your imagination, ask other people, ask them to ideate on your behalf. Do not judge, and just bear through, because your mind will know what it's doing. There's a really funny example. There was this truck under a bridge, and it was too tall to pass, and lots of engineers thought, you know, what do we do now? It was stuck, and a passerby came around and said, why don't you deflate the tires? And that's... just keep thinking until you make it. Okay, fourth stage, after you've done all these exercises, which seem quite formalistic so far, you prototype. You make something really low-key, low-tech, that you think might solve your problem. This might be a draft policy document. This might be a drawing of an app. This might be lots and lots of things. It really depends on what you're trying to solve. Keep prototyping, because you will never know what comes out of it and what you had assumed. Perhaps when you had an idea, you assumed that the finished product would look in a certain way. You might end up with something completely different, and I know I have lots and lots of time. So does anybody know what this is? If you don't know, raise your hand, please. Okay. Now put your hand down if you're beginning to figure out what this is. Okay, this is the same product, by the way. Just different iterations. There we go. Okay, And the last principle of design thinking is testing. So you empathize, you define a problem in a very specific way that lets you get rid of your biases. Then you have ideas, lots of ideas, no judgment and so on. You prototype and then you test. And it's very important that you're not afraid of failure and that you test in realistic scenarios. I'm not sure where they got Wi-Fi in the field, but this would never happen. It's a great stock photo. Okay, so what happens in design thinking? This sort of idea, this sort of thing. It's all very incremental, it's all very cyclical, and you don't stop until you've figured it out. You don't have that massive investment, okay, I've got this great idea, this app is going to change the lives of many disabled people, and I'm going to throw lots of money at it, and I've built it. And there are a few assumptions that I just didn't think of challenging at first. And I spent all that money and now I'm out of energy and now nobody believes in me anymore. No, this is very different. So, for all those who came here with an idea and not just for the gifts, there is luckily a very formal and, you know, if you're a developer, it's very easy to understand. It's a process, an algorithm almost, to trying out an idea. And all it takes is reading about this guy. This guy was at Google Ventures. He is very, very clever. He's a product owner there. And he did this process called the design sprint, which is kind of the greatest hit of design thinking, behavior science, and also business strategy. And he distilled it into 5 days or less. And you can do it with 7 people. 3 is okay. Presumably you have so many friends who might care about your idea. And you end up with one realistic and very testable facade. And often you end up with quite different assumptions to what you had started with. So here goes. Day one. Okay, it goes without saying, set 5 days apart. Maybe less. The first one you do, set 5 days to the side. If you don't think your idea is worth 5 days of focus, it's probably not worth pursuing. Day one is all about understanding. Now, typically, a bigger company, we don't have the luxury to start with a big company. In a bigger company, you'd have a big meeting with people who are far above you and they decide your targets and so on. All you have to do is to start with quite a noble goal. So the goal might be, I want to create a screen reader for very old devices in parts of the world where they have feature phones. I want to make those people have access to better content. Your brain is naturally starting to think about solutions now. This is not about solution. Design thinking is about problems and actions. So first thing you do is you ask yourself, how could we fail as a group? Now, don't always just pick your friends for this part of the discussion. Pick someone who you know might disagree with you, because that's really important. And then, as a group, again, start making a mind map of what the challenge is. What would you have to do to create this sort of phone application? Or what would you have to do for this environmental policy to stick and be successful? This is a bit of a luxury. They do it at Google because they can, but I can't imagine any normal people doing this. They invite lightning speakers. A very good way to bypass all of this lightning speaker stuff is to open YouTube and find some inspiring content to play around the problem. Maybe learn from how other people have tried to tackle it and just take a break from all the mapping and all the discussing. And then ask yourself the how might we questions. And remember, those how might we questions are always problems that are actionable. They're not solutions, because then you start your thinking with an encumbered mind that is already ingrained with bias. Okay, you pick your favorite how might we questions, you section off some of the map, and you go. Day two, all the people in group one diverge. There's no more group work. They go individually, they take a ream of paper, and they start sketching things out by themselves without talking to each other. Sometimes you might want to look at demos of the competition. Sometimes that might not make sense. I'm not sure what's going on with these bells. Okay, I'm just going to have to talk about that because it's not working. So you go away and you start sketching. Say if it were an application, you go away, and it doesn't matter if it's worth it or not, you just start sketching each screen. Like, okay, I want to log in, maybe I want to put my name, write my name down here, maybe I want to create a new diary that tracks my cycles that is actually not shared with the rest of the internet, and you write down what your ideal solution would be to all the problems you had talked about on the first day. And this is what happens. There's a cool thing called Crazy Eights, which I encourage you to do just, you know, for any challenge in day-to-day life. Take a sheet of A4, fold it up in 8, and do Crazy Eights, which means either you do 8 variations on the same problem, or you do 8 steps to solving a single problem. And you don't go to the abstract, you go to the concrete. You draw something, you write something, you make something, you draw an object, something like that, okay? Once you've done Crazy Eight, you get the best ideas from everybody and you stick them on a single piece, which is called solution sketch. Okay? Anyone can sketch. As you can see, some screenshots there, some of them are written, some of them are stick men, but they all make sense and they're all really helpful, and this ensures that we try and exclude as much bias as we can. On day 3 we converge, we decide what the best ideas were by sticking them up on the wall, sticking dots to them, critiquing them, doing straw polls, whatever. And we take those best ideas and the best concepts and we put them on a storyboard. This is very simple when you are making an app or building a system, but it might also be equally simple with when you're trying to make a new type of pencil or trying to draft a document for an MP, for example. And on day 4, you look at the storyboard and you try to make something. Try to make something that can successfully fool people into thinking it's usable and using it and interacting with it as closely as they would with the real thing. So, okay. For example, there are lots of tools where if you're building an application, you would just draw like rough screen prototypes. You would take the images and you would have areas where people can click, and then you go out in the wild and you test these with people, and a lot of people are, you know, they have all the insight they need to be able to tell you about their experience with it, and that's really important. Now, it's not just apps, that's just my area of expertise. My mother, for example, she is an environmental consultant and she does design thinking for her policy work. For service, for example, if you're trying to do a new barbershop that does things slightly differently, just get your friends, the same group from the first day, to be actors and to try it out on a group of people. Objects can be 3D printed, physical spaces can be arranged. And also I have a set of tools, if anyone's interested, to actually run these. There's a set of tools I can point you towards that make prototyping easy. Day 5 is test, and because it's day 5, 5 interviews are enough. And this is, in a nutshell, what Jake Knapp says you should do if you have an idea and if you're really committed to making it work. And the last bit is actually very, very important, because the last bit can avoid a lot of pain in the long run, such as the juicery. So that's like a summary. On the first day you map, then you sketch, and you decide, then you prototype, you fake it, and then you test it. You can do it in 2 days. For example, if you're going to test the bigger thing towards the end, you can do this. And I actually did this in a hackathon with ZSL. It was a conservation effort. And in 2 days, with complete strangers, we rallied around and we did this, and it was the first time I've done anything like design thinking. And it was really, really fascinating, and I can't recommend it enough. So this is, I think it's speed up about 1 million times, but this is the result of that hackathon. It's a conservation app that enables rangers to report incidents and then has a fancy algorithm that predicts incidents. But because most people in Africa don't have smartphones, it also has an interface where you can text it or call it and interact with it that way. So that was 2 days of testing and validating an idea. and it was 2 days of learning a hell of a lot about Africa and what sort of challenges they're facing technology-wise there. So we ended up with quite a different product to what we started with. If you want to learn more about design sprints, there's gv.com/sprint. It's also on the schedule. It's the link with my name. Also, if you are hanging around later, I do have a copy of the book, and if you have an idea, and if you really want to make it work, you know, you don't have to give me a beer, just talk to me, and I will be happy to oblige. By far the most important part of design thinking is the first one, and although you think you might be doing it, you probably aren't. I certainly know I have to make myself consciously empathize, especially when I think about solving other people's problems, which is weird. Okay, so people who have an idea, I hope this was useful. You should just go in and do it. If you can't spend 2 to 5 days of your time, then you know, you might have difficulty sustaining that idea further in the future. So just do it. There's very little risk. If you don't have an idea and you want an idea and you want to do this sort of thing, I'm going to quote Scylla Outworthy, who I've had the pleasure of attending a talk with a couple of weeks ago. She is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She's done some great work around nonviolent communication and conflict resolution, and she's a great proponent of design thinking, and she says you should start with a simple question if you don't have an idea, which is what breaks your heart. Thank you very much for listening to me.